We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're Dads on the Air. We're back, we're Dads on the Air.
Welcome back to Dads on the Air, this first day of March 2011. So we're into the first day of autumn. Pinch and a punch for everybody as we move away from summer. Today it's very hot and steamy in Sydney. It's about 31 degrees. There are scattered showers. So perhaps it's a sign, yes, despite the temperature, those showers might indicate that autumn, winter is on its way. So it's Bill Cable from Mediate Now. In the studio with me this morning is Ian Purdy from ianpurdy.com.
Yes, good morning, Bill. Good morning, listeners.
And we don't have Phil York with us today from Dads in Distress, but I'm sure he'll be listening to the show, and hopefully he'll be back with us next week.
Yeah, good morning, Phil. You listening?
So it's been an interesting week. Just on the first item of news, I wanted to mention that there's been some action with regard to Ray Hadley. Ray Hadley is a well-known shock jock on radio station 2GB in Sydney. And Ray is very upset because someone accused him of making threatening phone calls, and they took out an AVO against him. Ray defended himself in court and had the AVO application dismissed. But the bad news is that it cost him $109,000 to defend this case. And what's worse is his accuser is an undisclosed bankrupt, so there'll be no prospect of Ray getting his money back. This item has been brought to us by Peter of Sydney, and he's advised us that Ray is intending to campaign against this AVO system. Knowing Ray, this probably means that he'll discuss this issue every day on air for the next 6 months. He's already interviewed the Liberal Shadow Attorney General, Chris Smith, soon to be the new Attorney General of New South Wales, asking him how he can make some changes. Now, if people would like to... if you like live in New South Wales, or even if you don't, if you've had a false allegation made against you that resulted in an AVO application, how about you send an email to Ray Hadley at 2GB? If you just go to the website www.2gb.com and follow the links, you'll be able to send that note to Ray Hadley and perhaps give him some support. If you'd like to know a little bit more about what happened to Ray, just put in your search engine AVO case against Ray Hadley dismissed, and that'll lead you to the site. You can get all the information on this this particular incident. Now, later in the show, we'll be having two very interesting interviews. We'll be speaking to Dr. Richard Fletcher, who has recently produced a stimulating book called The Dad Factor, which deals with how father-baby bonding helps a child for life. And then our second interview will be with the popular presenter from Catalyst on the ABC, Dr. Jonica Newby. So it'll be great to talk to both those people a little later on. Now, Ian, you've got something for us?
Yes, I have here an article. That's, this one's not exactly new. It was actually the 22nd of December last year, written by Cathy Young, but I believe it is timely. This is to do with Julian Assange, the CEO of WikiLeaks, the people who have... they've publicised a lot of top secret American documents and upset a lot of diplomats and various other people around the world. And of course, everyone knows that Julian Assange is in a court case at the moment, charged with rape in Sweden. The article is entitled Julian Assange, Feminism and Rape. Cathy Young has written, "One unexpected consequence of the WikiLeaks saga has been to turn the spotlight on the debate over rape, sex and consent. Julian Assange, journalism's misbegotten enfant terrible, has been hounded by accusations of sex crimes after he vaulted to fame by releasing leaked classified documents on the internet. The charges were dismissed but then reinstated. Assange was arrested in London earlier last month and was released on bail while he fights extradition to Sweden. The nature of these charges has revived questions about where the law should draw the line between bad behaviour and criminal acts, and whether the feminist rethinking of rape has made it easy for any man to be targeted. As is widely known, Assange is accused of sexual offences against two women. Anna Arden, a left-wing activist who helped organise his speaking tour in Sweden last August, and photographer Sophia Willen. The prosecution asserts both encounters started out as consensual but later turned into assaults, partly, it seems, because of Assange's failure to use a condom despite the women's wishes. The triviality of the offences is compounded by the women's unvictim-like behaviour afterwards. Ardan had sex with Assange again and threw a party for him. Willem made him breakfast. It was only when the women learned of his two-timing that they went to the police, initially intending to force him to get tested for sexually transmitted diseases. In the United States, the sex charges have been met with near-unanimous derision across the political spectrum. Conservative media personality Glenn Beck and feminist writer activist Naomi Wolf have both satirized the case as one in which the man acted like a jerk and the women are seeking payback for hurt feelings. This unanimity is no doubt partly due to the fact that on the left, the instinct to back women claiming sexual abuse by men has been blunted by Assange's status as a rebel fighting the power, while on the right, scorn for feminist sexual ideology has proved stronger than the distaste for Assange. The article goes on to say, once feminist reformers rightly fought against laws that required a rape victim to fight her attacker to the utmost, by removing any element of actual or threatened force from the crime of rape makes it too easy to criminalize miscommunications and mourning after regrets. Should non-consent require a firm stop, or does it cover a hesitant or coy maybe we should stop, perhaps accompanied by actions that contradict the words? Is the man guilty of rape if the woman says early in the evening that she does not want to have sex but does not rebuff his overtures later? Is the woman a rapist if the roles are reversed? Writing the forcible part out of the definition of rape makes it much more of a two-way street. And I would argue completely contradicts, it takes away all of the criminalization of the act. If it's not forcible, you know, how can it be a crime? I mean, you know, I think in the bedroom, some people like force, you know. I mean, we're dealing with, you know, a huge range of sexual activities, from, you know, extreme fetishism right through to basic missionary sex, and, you know, lots of variations. Lots of people find different things sexually turning on. You know, there are people who like to be tied up and beaten while having sex. I mean, you know, to come up with an across-the-board sexual definition of rape that does not include force, I think, is opening a huge can of worms and basically making it a lot easier for innocent men to be victimized by callous women. What do you think, Bill?
Yes, well, it's a very legal area as to what constitutes consent or lack of consent, and the Swedish system is once again completely different from the English and Australian system.
We've recently had sweeping changes to the rape laws here in Australia, so that if a woman is intoxicated, she can claim the next morning that that she was raped. There was the case of the couple who had agreed to have sex. They went over to the park. The woman actually passed out because she was so intoxicated. Sorry, the man continued and had sex with her, and I think the magistrate at the time said that he made some comment that it was rape, but in terms of there being any crime or any kind of criminal activity, he was highly dubious, and there was a huge outcry from the feminists at the time that screaming for his head, that he was almost as bad as the rapist himself. But I mean, I think in the sexual, you know, in the bedroom, it's very difficult to try and go in there and draw a line, you know, without actual force being applied. You know, there are obvious situations, you know, where somebody is held down against their consent and raped, you know, and then other than that, you really are, there's a lot of grey areas, and you are really invited. I mean, the law must be seen to be done, and I don't know who it was that said that it's better that you know, 100 innocent people don't get locked up, you know, or that one murderer actually gets away with the crime than 100 innocent people get locked up. I mean, in this situation, I think men need to be protected from the vexatious claims of women. And it is a huge thorny can of worms. And of course, we have recently moved the barrier here in Australia, and it's just made the whole situation a lot more thorny. As the father of a son, I worry. I mean, my son, practically these days, you need to carry a contract around in your pocket, and if you're going to have sex with a woman, you need her to consent, sign the contract before you even touch her. Otherwise, you can be liable for all sorts of misdemeanors and crimes.
Right, well, a very contentious area. We might do something completely different. I wanted to refer to an article by Adele Horan in the Sydney Morning Herald recently, where the headline is "Angels Sought for Storybook Comfort." Adele Horan notes in her article that a background of trauma or neglect is not the only disadvantage children in foster care carry with them into the classroom. It's sad but true, but many have never ever been read a bedtime story. Now, Bronwyn Sheehan is the executive director of the Pajama Foundation, and what she's looking for is a group of people who she calls Pajama Angels to share their love of books and reading with children who have missed out on this important part of their development. In New South Wales at the moment, there are more than 16,000 children in foster care or with relatives because it's not safe or possible for them to live with their parents. She set up this foundation, which it encourages children to read more, or to have their book by having books read to them. And she quotes Mem Fox, who's a well-known children's author, who made the comment that every child should have 1,000 books read aloud to them before they start school. It seems to be aiming pretty high, but you can see the importance of that reading to children. Very, very important. So if people would like to help in this important work, there is a website. It's www.thepyjamafoundation.com. And if you go to the Pajama Foundation, you can get in touch with Bronwyn Sheehan. She'd be delighted to hear from you and see if we can get some more of these Pajama Angels to get out there and help children with their reading.
Yeah, no, that sounds like a good idea, a good cause. I've got one here. Court ban on granny smoking. One of the telegraphs last week. A magistrate has ordered a dad to keep his children away from smokers, including their grandmother, as part of a custody agreement. The man's de facto wife told the federal magistrate's court in Melbourne she did not want her children aged 4 and 5 spending time at the paternal grandparents' home, where she feared they would be exposed to passive smoking. The mother also feared for her children if they were present when the father and grandparents drank alcohol. But the magistrate went a step further to address the mother's concerns. The father will be required to keep the children away from anyone, including the paternal grandmother, smoking any cigarette or tobacco product in the presence of the children, he said. The ruling came despite the grandmother agreeing not to smoke around the children. Now, Fathers Advocacy Group, Dads in Distress, and our own Phil York is not here today to comment on this, but Regional Coordinator Lawrence Anderson said court orders such as these risked further litigation because they couldn't be policed. The mum could say they've come home smelling like smoke and then they're back in court, he said. The court's ruling was applauded by Quit Victoria Executive Director Fiona Sharkey, who said the negative health effects of secondhand smoke were well known. I'd have to agree with that. I think anything that keeps cigarette smoke and any smoke, you know, diesel fumes, anything away from children is a good idea, but especially tobacco, because we know how addictive the substance is and we know the damage that it does in the community, the great expense and the loss of life that it causes.
So finally, an article by Elizabeth Farrelly in the Sydney Morning Herald. We're 1 week away from International Women's Day on the 8th of March 2011, and Elizabeth in her article has posed the question, does feminism really want to feminise men? What in fact do women want? And she comes down to the view that most women would rather have men as men, but that she's taking account of the fact that women are moving more and more into men's roles, leaving men perhaps with few of their previous activities to take control of, whereas men were once needed to bring home the bacon, sign the mortgage, smack the children's bottoms as required, buy flowers 3 times a year. all this is done by the woman, except perhaps the smacking, which has been...
Outlawed in lots of states.
Yeah, that's not required. Well, I'm in favour of that, but if you take that out, it's certainly reducing the role of men in the community.
Well, I think it was Rich Zubati who said that men and women in today's society, women are being encouraged to act out of their masculine side, which is their weak side, and men are being encouraged to act from their feminine side, which is their weak side. So both of the sexes are being encouraged to act out of weakness.
Yes, it's sort of moving to a middle ground, which perhaps a lot of women are happy about, but it remains to be seen the effect on men. So we might be exploring this issue a little bit more in future weeks as to the role of feminism and where men are going. So we might go to a short break and we'll be back with our first guest, Dr. Richard Fletcher.
Okay, well, we're just waiting until Bill can get our first guest on the line, which I believe is happening as we speak. How are we going, Bill?
Yes, our first guest is Dr. Richard Fletcher. Dr. Fletcher leads the Fathers and Families Research Program at the University of Newcastle, and in the 1990s he pioneered the study of men's health and boys' health and founded the community-based group Fathers Against Rape. He's now produced, and in fact I think the launch has only been this morning, a stimulating book called The Dad Factor, which deals with how father-baby bonding helps a child for life. Dr. Fletcher, are you there?
Yeah, I am.
Oh, good morning, and welcome to Dads on the Air. I think it's the first time we've had the opportunity to talk to you on the show.
Yeah.
Now, Richard, Steve Bidoff has spoken very highly of your book. He said it's an incredibly important book, and Steve is well known to our listeners. In fact, we had him on the show on the 23rd of November last year, and so there's a lot of interest, I think, in your book and in the work you're doing. I wonder if you could perhaps tell us what led you into this into the findings that you've found in this book.
Well, I suppose I noticed a couple of things. One was I was running antenatal classes for dads, so the dads would come in with the mums and I'd take the dads off into another room and we'd talk about what was going to happen. We talked about their own fathers, and generally the blokes in these groups would say that their own fathers did a fairly good job, even though times were different then, of course, when they were born. And they also said that they wanted to do it differently to their own dads, be more involved. But when I asked them how long they were going to take off work, basically they said 2 weeks, which is the Australian average. And I said, if I said, why are you going to take 2 weeks? Well, they thought it was a funny question, like, what do you mean, why? I said, well, what are you going to do in the 2 weeks? And they said, well, we're going to help. You know, and these dads wanted a connection with their kids, they said that. But their idea about what they do with a young baby, that didn't make any sense to them, really. They didn't have anything to do, exactly. So that prompted me to see that there's a whole field of research there about young babies and how we now see the fathers have an important role, but fathers don't know about that. So that was one of the reasons for putting together. And in the class, of course, you've got an hour or something, or a couple of hours with them. You don't have time to really go into them that much. So I wanted to put something together that would lay out for dads. What is bonding? How does it work? I mean, we have a lot of science now. A lot of research has been going on about how this happens for dads. And so I wanted to put that down and give them something, dads something, about what it is that you might do in the first couple of weeks.
Yes, it's very interesting that I think, as you pointed out just then, the role of fathers is perhaps changing, and fathers now do want to become more involved. But I guess there's the same old problem that there's no guidebook that comes with babies, and the fathers, for all the good intentions, may not even know exactly what they should be doing as far as improving that bonding.
Yeah, I was talking to a GP last week about men that he saw in his surgery, and we weren't talking about fathers specifically, we were just talking about men. And he said, actually, one group I see in the surgery are blokes who've got a new baby. I said, oh, what do you see them for? He said, oh, usually for injuries. He said, they've got a new baby, they don't know what to do with themselves, so they get out and try and fix the roof or do a bit of repair work, and they hurt themselves. And so then I see them. He said, oh, I don't think they know what to do. So that was sort of like a different angle on it, but it's the same issue.
Mm. And really, I mean, I think you point out in your book the there are some mirroring neurons involved in this, and that even without knowing how the children do it, if the fathers do things like poke their tongue out or get involved, that the children can often mirror that activity, and they can start that bonding process going from very early days.
Yeah, I think dads often do have the idea that once the kid can kick a ball and do things like that, then they'll know what to do and they'll have a good role. Mm. But really, one of the things the midwives say is that fathers can, babies when they're born, have been able to hear for quite a while before they're born. So in the womb, they hear things. And one of the things they can hear is their father's voice. So if the father hasn't been particularly quiet around them, they will recognise the father's voice. And when they're born and they come out into the birthing suite, they look around for that voice when they hear it to see who it's attached to. So I think that's one of the other things that fathers need to know, is that the science of babies has changed. The idea that they just lie there feeding and making a mess, that's not what we understand now the way babies work. Like from day one, they're looking for a relationship. They're really trying to have some relationship with you. If you notice, and of course it doesn't happen in big high-five sort of ways, so fathers have to be clued in to notice that really intense look that baby gets when they're looking at your face, particularly, that baby is really trying to imprint that face on their brain and make some connection there with you. I think that's important for dads to know, that It's not just the dad trying to make a connection with the baby and the baby is indifferent or the baby doesn't care much. These babies do want a relationship with you.
Yes, it's really interesting that your findings are that in those first few hours the baby's primed to react to the father and to get that interaction going, because you often hear that dads will say, oh, you know, I'll play with him more when he can kick a ball, or engage in some conversation or have some sort of more meaningful what they see as more meaningful interaction. But that those first few hours, even, it's very important to get that that relationship going.
And I think it's just a question of knowing what to look for, because when babies can smile and gurgle at you when they're a bit older, then it's more obvious that they're delighted to see you. But even early on, there's those moments when they're relaxed and they've had something to eat and they're not sleepy, when they do want to interact. And I think that's an important thing for dads to know. But it also continues. I think that's the other good point, that I think dads underestimate how important their rough and tumble play is when these are toddlers like preschoolers. That's another really important facet, which is covered in the book, because this is about young children as well as babies, that this rough and tumble play is actually affecting children's brains, the way they develop, in a good way. So these are important things that dad do, not just mucking around and this is what you do when you don't have anything better to do.
Yes, and sometimes this is raised by the mothers. And I note in your book you've said that there's no suggestion that in claiming a father's role with young babies that you are seeking to displace mothers or to minimise the importance of the mother's connection. It's just that the fathers can also have an increased or have a definite role in raising the children.
Yeah, I think it is a team effort. Obviously, I think when you think about it, of course it's a team effort. We're not thinking that dad should push mum out of the way and do everything himself. But I think, and there's lots of cases, you know, like postnatal depression is a real issue, you know. Maybe even one in five mothers, somewhere between one in five and one in ten, will have this. And that's a serious thing. And dads have an important role there. I see dads in the group I run with. There's a group for dads whose wives have postnatal depression. And those dads are really struggling with a whole lot of things, you know, looking after the baby often, looking after the mum, trying to make money because she stopped work, those sort of things. Those dads are under phenomenal pressure, and I think there isn't nearly enough support. This book is one way to support them, in the sense that it gives them good information, but I think there could be a lot more support for dads out there.
Yes, because I've seen some research saying that the postnatal depression is also now a factor with dads, so it's coming out, as you say. And one of the factors is, of course, the mother having the postnatal, but it's a real factor with men as well.
That's part of the big shift, I think, in the science of it. So that we've known since the 80s that if the mother is depressed, if you take a group of babies and you look at those whose mothers were depressed after the birth for a period, and you follow those babies up, well, they have more behaviour problems and they don't do so well. We've known that for a long time. I think it's only since about the middle, 2005, I think, was the first really big study, 10,000 fathers they followed up, and the mothers. And that in that study, if the dad was depressed 2 months after the birth, they followed those children until they were nearly four. And if your dad was depressed, you were twice as likely to have behaviour problems, three times as likely if you were a boy. So that was quite separate from whether the mum was depressed. That was a huge finding for showing that fathers have an impact just like mothers on the way children develop, and that just to pay attention to mothers, while that's a good idea, that isn't nearly enough. We need to be looking at fathers in the same way.
Yes, and that is the importance of the father-baby bonding, isn't it, for the child's emotional, physical and cognitive development?
Yeah, that's if you want the best for your baby, you should get in there. Yeah.
And there are also some physical effects of dad playing with his child, I believe, to do with those neurons in the brain of the growing infant.
Yeah, because we now... The 1990s was called the decade of the brain, in a way to capture all the research that was going on. And that was because we developed better techniques of looking into people's heads without having to kill them first. Which is, as you can see, is a good idea.
Yes, possible, yes.
I mean, we could always do that with animals, of course. So we had a lot of science about animal brains, and we had some models there. But when we developed techniques for looking into brains and seeing how they're working, that led to a huge development. And that's when people really began to realize that when you're playing with your baby, you're not just entertaining them or having a good time, you're actually changing the architecture of their brains. That during that time, the way babies learn how to relate to people and the brain sections that all interconnect to allow them to do that, that's formed in those interactions. So I think that new appreciation that brains grow and develop through the relationships they have, that's a huge thing for fathers to get hold of. So that that idea that you bring home the money, you look after the house, you do the outside work, all of that's important, but the relationship you have with the baby will be what will be affecting day-to-day the brain development that will then affect how that child handles stress, for example, when they're going through school, when they're teenagers, when they're, and even when they're adults.
Yes, and how important is that, that the child learns in a non-threatening way to deal with frustrations and all the different emotions that that he's going to confront in his day-to-day life in a safe environment with his father or her father?
Yeah, that's why I think it's a good idea to really think about what rough and tumble play means, because we know from animal studies that if you stop animals doing rough and tumble with each other when they're growing up, then they're not as good at solving problems when they're adults. Now, you can do that in a laboratory with animals. Of course, you can't do that with children, and you shouldn't. But we do think that the way that fathers rough and tumble, because if you think about rough and tumble, that's a terrific place to figure out a whole lot of things if you're a kid. So you're trying, your whole body's engaged because you're trying to wrestle your dad to the ground. Your emotions are involved because you really want to win, and you really are tackling somebody who's very big and powerful. We've just been doing some research in The Hunter where we're getting dads to play wrestle with their children and videotaping it. And when you look at those videos, you can see those kids are not just having a good time, although they often scream and rush for their dad with enthusiasm when he's lying on the ground. But they're also really concentrating because it's really an effort for them to, you know, if you think about a four-year-old, which is the ones we're filming, compared to their dad, there's no question that their dad could win if he wanted to. But the idea that they are powerful and they can hold him down or grab his arm and make him do this, that's a hugely exciting, I think, and terrifying thing for a small child. Mm. And so that's a wonderful learning opportunity for dads to deliver to their kids. They can learn how to handle all those emotions.
Now, an intact family, you've got the mother and the father there. I guess the father, in his time with the children, can specialise in the rough and tumble.
Yep.
What about the separated dads? Do they can't rough and tumble all the time. I guess they've got to settle down to some parenting roles at other times as well.
Yeah, they do. And I think it's hard for dads who only have that limited contact to know how best to use it. I think one of the things that comes out of the research that's there for separated dads, which is probably no surprise to them, is that the more clear it is to the child that you want the contact with them, which is quite separate to the blue you might be having with the mother, the more clear it is to that child that you want the contact with them, the better it's going to be for that child's development. So that even though you might be separated and even though there might be conflict, the idea of a team, in the sense that this child thinks, wow, both of my parents, although they might not get on, they both want to know me, want to do things with me, are interested in how I'm going, want to be with me. All of that is really key for dads who are separated. And that means that not only in the times that you're with them, of course, which might be circumscribed by circumstances, not only the times you're with them, but the times you're not with them. All those ways that you might contact them and let them know through yourself or through others. That's important, I think, for dads.
Yes, I mean, this whole area, it's so interesting. I mean, you're pushing into areas that perhaps traditional fathers, I think back to my father and certainly my grandfather, wouldn't they wouldn't really be thinking along these lines. I mean, they saw their role, I think, as the breadwinner and really not much, not a lot of interaction with the children, whereas there is this growing tendency now. Dads are expected to have the interaction. They want to have the interaction with the children as well as the traditional roles. And you're, as I say, you're going into these areas that forcing men to think of things that perhaps they haven't been doing for a long time. And I'm very interested in this that forum you conducted where you put five questions to a number of men and you start answering themselves. I mean, what do you? I just got looking at the first one here. What would you say is great about being a man? That must have posed some very interesting responses, I suspect.
Yeah, it does, and it raises that whole idea about. Often that's a novel question. I mean, I did that more than 1,000 times around Australia, that panel, in different settings and with different sorts of blokes. And when I get a group out the front to answer those questions, then it's always a new question. Like, nobody says, oh, that question again, what's great about being a man? Oh, gosh, how boring, we already talked about that. They never say that. They always go, what? What's great about being a man? So there's that sort of sense that this is a novel idea to be thinking about what's wonderful about being a man or what's wonderful about men. That's a novel idea. And I think that when men answer that question, there's always some hesitancy there initially. And often, for many men, it's a hard question. Well, I don't know. They often think about, well, you know, we don't sit down to pee, or what is great, come to think of it. And then those questions are designed really to just give, I don't know, thinking space, I suppose you might say, to men and for others to hear. So always the audience. Blokes come out the front, they volunteer. I say, here's some questions. Nobody else gets asked the questions, just me. And whatever the audience, and I've done it with all sorts of groups, the audience is always really interested in what these blokes are going to say, because they've never heard any man answer those questions. Like, just even a simple question like, who's a man you admire? A simple question like that. The audience leans forward because they want to, well, what is this guy going to say? Who does he admire? And, of course, the first thing they usually think of is some football star. And that's hardly ever what blokes say, because they're often quite frank in this discussion. It isn't like they're pretending to impress people. They're often parents who have come out. Or I've done it with, diesel mechanics, police, GPs, all sorts of occupation groups. And when they get to that point, one of the biggest groups, when I just ask that question, tell me about a man you admire, one of the biggest groups is their father. And the reason they admire him is often not because he was some superstar, but because he sacrificed. He put the family first in some way. So this is not, people talk about as if this is a new idea that men might think about their families. But in my experience, thinking about that number of panels I've done where people have answered seemingly honestly like that, they don't say that. They don't say superstars are the only people to look up to. And nor do boys. When we ask boys the same question, they don't say superstars. Well, they say superstars more of the time than the dads, but they also say their uncles or their dads or their an older male they look up to. So they're also a big group for boys.
And these panels, you have boys in the audience who are listening to what the older men are saying, I guess?
Often not, no, because if I'm doing diesel mechanics, I'm doing it at their work, or power station workers, then it's a sort of a workplace environment.
Mm-hmm.
Where we've done the boys, we did a whole lot of work in schools where we got boys to be in a panel, and often when we ask boys, for example, out the front, we put 100 teachers in the room to listen, and that is revelatory for those teachers. Usually they've never heard the boys answer these sort of questions. They've never thought about what the boys think about these questions, or if they have, they haven't had a chance to talk to them about it. So we ask them, you know, what do they admire about a man, what are they proud of about being boys. Those sort of questions are really important, I think, for teachers to hear, for example, because it gives them a whole new approach to those boys, that they think, god, that rat bag, he never says anything like he should. He never does what I ask him, and here he is saying these amazing things.
Yes, I think the other side of the coin, which I'm sure the teachers would be interested in too, is what is difficult about being a man at this point in history.
Yeah, that's right. And that's pretty uniform, that the difficulty is that the roles have changed, that there's not much guidance. I mean, that is this generation of fathers, if you think about fathers, this generation of fathers are pioneers, because our fathers, like the men who are just having a baby today, are on average 33 years old. Mm. So you think about 33 years ago, then at that stage there was no paternity leave even discussed, let alone granted. Men weren't that welcome in the hospital in terms of being there at the birth. And the idea that you would be involved with your new baby was a pretty far out notion. So this generation are having to figure it out like from scratch, really, I think. And this is a pivotal generation to figure out a new way of being a dad.
So is this cause for optimism that those changes you just mentioned, they all sound like good changes to me?
Yeah, I think it is. I'm optimistic. And the men I see in these groups and I talk to, the dads, I think the optimism is because there's a drive to connect, which is, when you think about it, dads are now matching the drive that the babies have. The babies were born with a drive to connect, to have a relationship. Dads now are both having the drive. There's information available, not just this book, but there's more information available. And some of the structures are changing. So I think next year we are supposed to get 2 weeks paid paternity leave. So that'll be a very small step, but a step in the right direction.
As we're speaking with Dr. Richard Fletcher, who's the author of a new book called The Dad Factor, How Father-Baby Bonding Helps a Child for Life. And, Richard, that's available through most bookshops, I imagine, or you could go direct to the publisher.
Yeah, you can get it from Finch Publishing website. I think Angus and Robertson's are in strife at the moment. I think they're in receivership, so they're probably not a good place to look for it, but all the other bookshops should have it.
Well, they might be selling it cheap.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I think Angus and Robertson and Borders have both have problems, but as far as I know, the administrators are still running them, so hopefully your book is available there. But as you say, you can go direct to the publisher. That's I think the website is www.finch.com.au.
Yep.
And the book is called The Dad Factor, from Richard Fletcher, Dr. Richard Fletcher. Richard, where do you see the way from here? Do you see the fathers getting more of these types of roles you've been talking about and making it better for their relationship with their children?
Yeah, I think there's a general trend that way, that the fathers, in wherever they are working towards. I think there's a groundswell, I think, of change happening around that. We haven't seen it reflected very well in the policy area yet, so there's a lot of work to do there. But on the day-to-day level, everywhere you look, fathers are, you know, with primary school children and their schools, with children and their health. We've done some work with fathers of children who've got autism. They're an enormous group who've got a fantastically difficult situation that they're doing wonderfully in. So I think there's lots of places you can look and see dads moving in a way that means more involvement and more connection. I think that's the key.
Yes, and we can hope that the legal practice changes as well, to allow fathers to see their children more frequently than has been the case in the past, where it was every second weekend and half school holidays.
Yes, there was a real step forward when we got rid of that in the legal framework, I think, that notion of the, in Newcastle, where I'm from, they call it the Newcastle arrangement, every second weekend and stuff. So I think it's a step forward to get to a point where saying, well, both parents are important.
Yes, and I think I've also heard them called the Disneyland dads, or the where it's just for entertainment rather than actually those more meaningful roles that you've been talking about as well.
Mm.
So, Richard Worth, I think we're running out of time, but could I thank you very much for coming on the program and talking about your book, The Dad Factor. I know you had the launch this morning. I hope that went well, and I can just hope that the book also does well, because these messages that you are talking about really have to get out there, and it's just so important, the work that you're doing.
Okay.
So, yes, once again, thanks for coming on the show, Dr. Richard Fletcher.
Okay, nice to talk to you.
Thanks, Richard.
Bye.
is gone. We'll
meeting your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
Welcome back to Dads on the Air, this first day of March 2011. And our next guest is Dr. Jonica Newby. Jonica is a former veterinarian turned reporter, producer for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation's flagship TV science program, Catalyst. And Catalyst, I see, has been going for just over 10 years, about the same time as Dad's on the Air. Jonica, good morning.
Hi there.
Welcome to Dad's on the Air.
Thank you.
Jonica, I was wanting to talk to you particularly about the show you put up on the 9th of September last year. It was called Secrets of the Super Dads Part 2.
Right. Yes.
And look, it was it's a fantastic show. Very interesting findings. And you've been speaking to people all over the world. For anyone that would like to see the show again, you can go to the Catalyst website, or if you Google Jonica Newby, you can find the show. And there's some very interesting findings. What led you to? I mean, with your background, what led you to explore the the role of fathers in the way that you did?
Well, I guess you refer to my background. I trained originally as a vet, although I haven't actually worked in that field for about 20 years. I've been a full-time science broadcaster for 15. I guess I came across the idea that fathers might be special in the animal world, and this is in fact what the first part, the first half hour was about. I had seen some research to indicate that fathering was incredibly rare in the animal kingdom. One in 10 mammals practice active fathering. So we're unusual right before you start, and most people wouldn't even realise that. And then the research was starting to come through about 10, 15 years ago that in species where fathers participated actively, there were hormonal changes during the pregnancy and soon after that actually helped prepare the fathering behaviour. And so that piqued my interest. And then as I was watching, I saw, oh, there's a bit of a hint that that might happen in humans as well. And of course, in the first part, we explored that idea that there is some sort of genetic hormonal priming that allows males in our species to care for young. Then the second part, which then looked at, well, once you become a dad, what happens? What kind of roles do you play? And particularly, I guess, the question of our time being, can you be a good dad and an absent dad or a non-custodial dad or non-primary carer dad, whatever term you want to use? I was fascinated by that because it's clearly a big social question of our time.
Yes.
Not only that, I mean, when my father and mother split up when I was 8, they were the first of a wave. Now, I personally have never felt particularly damaged by that, but it's been interesting then a generation later to see some of my male friends who have separated, and the degree of commitment they give to their kids, just in terms of physical time and the way they do the parenting, is very, very different to a generation ago.
Were you able to maintain that relationship with your father after the separation?
Absolutely. I saw him on Saturday night, and we'll again this week, and absolutely have, yes. But it was a very different time, and I was very curious about what the research was saying now, given we've had a 40-year experiment, if you like, about what the impact on kids was, and secondly, whether there's been any shift over 40 years in this non-custodial dad situation and how it impacts on the kids. So, yeah, I had all these thoughts going through, and doing the two specials was a labour of love in that way.
Mm. Yes, well, going right back, perhaps not back to your veterinary days, but your interest in men and or men people as being types of animals. I mean, people need that long nurturing, don't they, after they're born, compared to most other mammals or most other animals.
Absolutely, and in the rare cases where parenting and I mean nurturing behaviour, caregiving, providing food, providing physical comfort, that sort of thing, just from a purely animal behaviour point of view, that only seems to evolve in cases where the burden, if you like, of raising a child is too much for one parent alone. I mean, we do more than that as a human species. We also pull in aunts and grandmas and sisters and brothers and all of that. It's all in if you look at a hunter-gatherer society. But you see, in most mammals, the mother is the only important one because she produces milk. And so long as she can do all the caring and, look, thrust the little kids out there at age 6 weeks or whatever if they're mice, that's all that's needed. And so the fathering behaviour evolves in situations like the human where you've got caregiving for decades,
yes,
where it's way too big a job for one person.
Yes, I was very interested in Professor Murray-Paul Austin's comments that we're with this greater role of the fathers, and when things go wrong, you know, we often hear about postnatal depression for women, but she was saying that the postnatal depression with men is about 1 in 10, which is not that much less frequent than it is for the women.
Yes, and again, anecdotally, I was influenced. I mean, I'm in my early 40s, and I was influenced by the experiences of my friends. I had seen a couple of men get postnatal depression, even more likely if their partner has postnatal depression, but of course they're not allowed to admit it because the woman often plunges even deeper, if you like, or they express it differently. But yes, it is surprisingly common, and if you look at the research, and there have been some big longitudinal studies in the UK particularly, some impacts have been identified negatively for the child if you do have postnatal depression in the male. Specifically, they were looking at language development in young kids. I mean, these are all trends rather than absolutes. Of course, none of these things ever suggest that you will have a bad outcome for your kid. Most kids do fine. But it is a trend that shows, on average, if you've got postnatal depression in a man, you're more likely to have a negative impact on the child, because it's a form of absence, in a way. Let's say you've just got a postnatally depressed dad, but the mum's doing it okay. Well, the trouble is she's then doing it on her own. Mm. So she's effectively having to be a single parent at a time when, you know, the more in you've got, the better off everyone is.
Yeah. And if the father in that situation where the mother has postnatal depression, I guess what you're saying...
Are we talking about the male or the female having the postnatal depression?
If the female has it, then the father then has to take on a couple of roles, hasn't he? Presumably he still has to have the rough and tumble play, but he also has to do more of the parenting role because the mother's not there for...
That's right. And I think, obviously, in this generation, guys are tending to do more of that anyway. I mean, there's cultural differences right across the community, but just on average, they're doing much more of that anyway. But that's right. If the woman, the mother, is... The depression, obviously, is a form of absence for the infant. They're not there emotionally or in some cases physically even to do the caregiving because it's too overwhelming. So in all those circumstances, the message is go see someone earlier rather than later.
Yes, and because Dr. Amato, I think, who's also on your program, talked about the bad effect on the children of not having the involvement of, say, of the father, that risk of problems increases double from, say, 10% to 20%.
Yeah, that's right.
So the role of the fathers is very important, and I guess that's another reason why if there is a depression problem, they should get treatment as soon as possible.
Well, that's exactly right. And one thing I didn't have room to put in my half hour there is that his research also shows no dad is better than a bad dad. In other words, if you've got one of those people who has by themselves a negative influence on the child, then so it's not in all cases that it's better if the dad is there, obviously. But on average, that's right. Once there's a split, statistically, going back to the 70s, it has been associated with doubling the risk of poor outcomes on every single level for the children. And again, that was one of the things I was interested in. I'd heard those statistics. I knew they were pretty robust, and they're kind of disturbing given how common split families are these days. And I was curious to know whether, as a society, those trends are shifting over the 30, 40 years. And it's a little early to say, but the good news is that the early indications, because it'll be another 10, 20 years before we really know all this stuff, how it all panned out, the indications are that absent dads or the split families, on average, are getting better at it and working out how to have more shared custody, I guess, but that's one way of putting it. But certainly having a fathering influence through however many days or weeks you get in a year, that is more than just taking to the Disneyland. That is the full gamut of fathering behaviours, of advice, of boundaries, as well as the fun.
Yes, I think Professor Amato raised that point that it wasn't just spending time. It's what you do when you're together that where you get the benefit. So I suppose that's an area where dads perhaps need a bit more education as to what they should be doing.
Yeah, quite possibly. I mean, a lot of the dads I contacted for this, obviously I was looking for certain archetypes, but they already had organised. I mean, they didn't have equal custody, as in number of days, but they certainly had organised it so they had regular school nights as well as weekends, and that's obviously part of it, the routine life. If it's possible, it's not always possible, but that is part of having that whole fathering experience.
So is that what you see as what it takes to be a good dad, to be involved in the day-to-day activities?
Well, this is what the researchers say. you can't quantify number of days or anything like that, but overall the parenting style has to include just the general care and even discipline, I guess. You know, or boundaries is the modern the modern word for that. Sorry, boundary setting and maintaining, as opposed to just the fun stuff.
Yes, and I guess that's a general problem that I think sometimes today parents are scared to parent, even when they're in intact families. They don't set those boundaries as perhaps as often as they should. And but with a father in a separated situation, it's even harder because he, having set the boundaries, he doesn't have the opportunity to sort of, you know, to sweeten it up a little bit and get back onto a good, even relationship keel.
Yeah, there's that fear of losing the relationship,
You set the boundaries, you have a bit of a heart-to-heart talk with the child, and then the child is gone for a week or 2 weeks. And so it's very difficult, more difficult for a father in that situation to set the boundaries than in an intact family. So that's not easy. Now, Johnny, I know you've got to race off. Have you got just a couple other questions, I suppose? What would you say your overall finding is as far as the changes where fathers now there is a tendency for fathers to see more of their children after separation, but it's still a very small proportion, isn't it? And do you see there is an effect on the children?
Well, this is where it's a little early to tell from the statistics, but to be honest, I don't have all the stats in front of me anymore. This was a year ago that I had all that stuff at my fingertips.
Yep.
And a lot of it didn't end up in the final program because you make decisions about things. But there were indications in the literature that on a couple of measures that doubling thing. In fact, Paul Amato put it as a guesstimate as opposed to a general quantifiable amount. He said, look, let's say that separated parenting doubles the risk of your children having any of these problems from 10% to 20%. You can roughly halve that increased risk by doing the right kind of separated fathering.
Mm. Well, that's a positive message, isn't it?
And it's still, you know, I look at the others, don't forget the flip side of that. Let's say that means 15% as opposed to 20%. 85% of kids aren't going to have those negative outcomes.
Mm.
So let's remember that they're talking about trends, not destiny.
So when parents separate, they don't necessarily need to panic that their children are going to wind up with emotional and psychological problems and depression and all the other things we hear about.
No more than kids with intact families,
Mm. But there are a lot of things you can do to
ameliorate that increased risk, yes.
So that's the positive news. Well, we're speaking with Dr. Jonica Newby, a presenter and writer on Catalyst ABC TV. Jonica, I think we have run out of time, but thank you very much for being on the show, and it's great to talk to you after seeing you on the TV for all these years.
Thank you. You're most welcome.
Thanks, Jonica.
Wasted kisses, red turns to blue. My kisses were wasted on you. Wasted hours and wasted pursuit. I was wasting my time picking the wrong fruit. The storm clouds opened. Down came the rain. Everything I thought was precious went down the drain. Wasted promises, wasted lies, wasted kisses, wasted goodbyes. Wasted kisses, red turns to blue. My kisses were wasted on you. Wasted hours and wasted pursuit. I was wasting my time picking the wrong fruit. Here today, gone tomorrow. The only thing that's left of value is sorrow. Wasted kisses, a big wasted mess. We were wasted, I confess. Yeah, we were wasted, baby, wasted. Wasting all my time and all my kisses on you. Wasted, baby, wasted. Wasting all my time and all my kisses on you. Yeah, we're
kisses. Red turns to blue. My kisses were wasted on you. Wasted hours and wasted pursuit. I was wasting my time picking the wrong fruit.
And we were wasted,
wasted kisses. Red turns to blue. My kisses were wasted on you. Red turns to blue. My kisses were wasted on you. Wasted hours, wasted pursuit. I was wasting my time picking the wrong fruit.
Wasted kisses, wasted.
Stress meeting your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
Welcome back to Dads on the Air this first day of March 2011. And there were some very interesting links between our guests this morning, between Dr. Jonica Newby, who did her program in September last year on Catalyst called Secrets of the Superdads, and Dr. Richard Fletcher, who's recently produced his new book called The Dad Factor, which also explores those important early links between fathers and their children. And the more we look at this area, the more we discover what it takes to be a good dad. There are behaviours we can learn, and there's the innate biology. The innate biology comes from the fact that, as Jonica mentioned in the interview, that with humans there is a long period of nurturing, unlike other mammals, and that has led to the need for the father to have a social role, to be responsible for father care with the children. And this evolved way back when raising a human child with its big brain became too big a job for one parent alone. So in perhaps some people are confused about the role of fathers. They think that perhaps mothers can do it on their own. There's been a recent movie that's come out where there are two lesbian mothers, and the suggestion of the story is that two mothers can do it better than a conventional mother and father family. But in fact, if you go back through the prehistory, going right back to the first when humans first evolved, the role of the fathers has always been seen as important, and this is now being supported by all the modern science. As I say, Dr. Fletcher has written about it. Dr. Jonica Newby has talked about it in her Catalyst program, and there's a wealth of robust research in this area. I can refer you to The Dad Factor by Richard Fletcher. I can refer you to the Catalyst show on which aired in September last year, 2010. But there, as I say, there's a lot of research in this whole area, and if people are interested, there's enough to keep us all busy for a long time. So it's great to get that conflating of opinions in on this important area. So we might just move to a couple of news stories. I think we've got a couple of news stories. We've got time for those before we finish up today. So, Ian, you've got something for us.
Yes, I've got one here. This appeared in the Sun Herald this week under the heading Serial Offenders in Spotlight. This is my old bugbear. We're basically feeding our children too much sugar, fat and garbage. Here's a case of breakfast cereals. Serial Offenders in Spotlight was the heading, as I said. Ruth Williams wrote, Not so long ago, it was easy to tell which foods were good for you and which were not, what was a staple and what was a treat. Now it is less clear, and public health advocates will tell you that is no accident. It is a result of clever marketing strategies by the powerful food industry. Kellogg's Cocoa Pops, for example, are fortified with calcium, iron and zinc. The packet describes them as nutritious grains of puffed rice. However, they also contain 30% sugar. As brand names go, vitamin water could hardly sound healthier, and it does contain vitamins as well as 5 teaspoons of sugar in every bottle. And this is an aside, that one sucked me in. I thought, oh, this is a great thing, get my son off the sugar drinks, which were causing him to become overweight and irritable, and he was insisting on having them all the time. So I thought, oh, here's something healthy, we'll get him onto vitamin water, it's not fizzy and it's full of vitamins. And only to find out that every bottle contains 5 teaspoons of sugar. Anyway, the article goes on to say, but as most Australians are getting enough nutrients in their diets, it is the manufacturers that benefit most from minerals and vitamins being added to food. It is often the most highly processed sugary and salty breakfast cereals that are most heavily marketed to children. And the marketing approach appears to be that if you sprinkle some nutrients on them, they can masquerade as a healthy food, said Dr. Mark Lawrence, Associate Professor at Deakin University's School of Exercise and Nutrition Sciences. The food industry boasts one of the most effective industry lobby groups, the Australian Food and Grocery Council, which is headed by former pharmacist and ACT Chief Minister Kate Carnell. The council, whose 150 members include most of the big packaged food and drink makers, says it is committed to fighting the obesity epidemic. Yeah, well, really committed after they've lined their own pockets and got their poisonous products into our children. But public health experts say more is needed to avert an increasingly fat future. To some extent, we have to take the blame, says Maggie Nile, a semi-retired public health nutritionist. The food industry, had dominated the agenda without any of us being able to do anything about it. They have the ear of the health department and the ministers. We have tried, but we don't have the lobbying money. So they're making all this money out of flogging unhealth, disease and obesity to our children, and then they use it to lobby the government to keep these disgusting practices happening. And as parents, it's becoming more and more difficult. I mean, food nutrition is a minefield. You just don't know. The packaging is misleading, especially, as I said, with that vitamin water stuff. That got me. I thought that was a great thing to suddenly appear in the fridge alongside the sugar drinks, but it turns out that it's just a repackaged form of the sugar drink, and that it has very little benefit in terms of the vitamins, and a huge downside in terms of the fact that it's full of sugar. So it's a minefield. We really do need more regulation. We need these people to be held to account, that they shouldn't be able to advertising to children, getting children involved, and of course the pester power and all of this, which the children are able to unleash on parents, who of course have more stressful lives, more things they have to worry about, and now they're assaulting our children. It's disgraceful. Bill.
I just want to refer to an article in The Guardian on Friday, 18 February 2011. It was headed "Fathers Recognised as Crucial to the Family" in a UN report. In this UN report, it was stated the concept of fatherhood needs to be dramatically readjusted to bring it into line with the modern world. This report, which was launched in New York, referred to the fluid and changing ways in which men care for and support children. It said that men should stop being measured against a maternal template. The report is called "Men in Families and Family Policy in a Changing World." It was noted there by Margaret O'Brien, co-author of the report and co-director of the University of East Anglia's Centre for Research on the Child and Family, that men are now more likely than ever to live separately from their children and to father children outside marriage. In the UK, just 11% of parents share the care equally of their children after separation and divorce. That sounds like a similar story as in Australia. The Office for National Statistics General Lifestyle Survey found that in 2009, 86% of stepfamilies in Great Britain were formed by a couple with children from the woman's previous marriage or cohabitation, while only 8% of stepfamilies cared for children from the man's previous marriage or cohabitation. Just 7% of stepfamilies live with children from both partners' previous marriage or cohabitation. The report found that increasingly different men, including grandfathers, uncles, stepfathers, foster fathers, older brothers, cousins, and other men, play various fatherhood roles in children's lives. The report said that any of these men, singly or collectively, may be the child's primary source of male support, and saw that fathering is fundamentally a social construction. This was countered by Rob Williams, chief executive of the Father Institute, who said that while men can certainly father their own children as well as those from other relationships, the report is wrong about it not being a key to a child to know who their biological father is. It can still be a key to the child's sense of identity to know who their biological father is, even if they are brought up by a nurturing and loving stepfather. This utilitarian view of fatherhood doesn't capture what it is to be a father or what it is to have a father at all. Being a father is much more than just providing food, water and nurturing. It is about where you come from.
Yes, it's a betrayal.
So, and there's no doubt that child outcomes are significantly improved by a meaningful relationship with both parents. And this cannot be achieved by a temporary relationship. It should be by shared parenting. Now, if anything comes out of this show today, we've been speaking to the experts about the critical role of fathers in developing children. One can only hope that this is recognised by the family court and by some of the groups who are pushing very hard to take fathers out of their children's lives just at the very time when all the research is confirming the importance of fathers.
When the children need them the most.
Yes, so yes, we can only hope that by spreading the news, by Dads on the Air, by any other means we have at our disposal, that that message will get out there. And perhaps it might be a good time to, even in the week coming up, as I say, next Tuesday is, in fact, International Women's Day, the 8th of March. What we are not seen, should never be seen as putting down the efforts that women make, but we equally need the support for fathers and fathers to get recognised for the important role that they have in bringing up the children.
Yes, we put down the women that put down the role of fatherhood. That's, I think, our role. I mean, anybody who has a healthy approach realises that fathers and mothers are equally important in the development and lives of children. All of the research confirms this, and that's been our editorial position here at Dads on the Air for the last 10 years. Now, I've got one more article here. This one is from the Daily Telegraph last Thursday. Bad side of veggies is the heading. Pesticides hurt fertility. Pesticides found on fruit and vegetables could be doing untold damage to male fertility, a major study suggests. 30 of 37 crop chemicals tested interfered with the action of testosterone, the sex hormone critical to a healthy male reproductive system. Worryingly, 16 of the 30 had not previously been linked with male hormone disruption. Environmental campaigners said the effects could be particularly severe in the womb, with lack of testosterone feminizing unborn boys, raising their odds of reproductive defects at birth and low sperm counts and testicular cancer in later life. Pesticides have also been blamed for a host of ills, from incurable brain conditions such as Parkinson's disease to stunting the intelligence of the unborn child. So that's very, very serious stuff. We really, really do need to look at the sort of pesticide things that are basically to keep insects off our food, ways of getting the pesticides off the food before they are consumed. We need ways of cleaning the food. The food shouldn't just be ripped out of the field, put in a truck, shipped to Woolworths, and then flogged to whoever. It needs to be cleaned. These pesticides are toxic and extremely dangerous, and they need to be removed before these vegetables and fruit are consumed.
Now, just coming back to some problems for dads. There's a report here, 23rd of February 2011, by Glenn Sachs from Fathers and Families, which is a US organisation, and we think we have some problems here with child support orders, but There's a report of a case here, Burr versus Burr, that's B-I-R versus B-I-R, in Indiana, where there's no levelling off of child support obligations at high income. And in this case, there was a petition for divorce, and the father was ordered to pay $4,300 per month for support of the two children. The mother filed for modified child support based on new guidelines, and she called for support to be raised from $4,300 a month to $1.965 million per year. Both children are healthy, have no special needs. The father submitted evidence that the children's needs are approximately $8,600 a month, or $103,200 a year. But the court rejected this, and they also rejected the mother, but they came up with a new proposal. They rather than saying $8,600 a month, they ordered it should be $8,600 per week, or $447,200 every year. Now, in the US, it seems that family court judges are given so much discretion they can make these mystifying orders without ever having to explain themselves. I mean, how do you go from needs of $8,600 a month to ordering that it should be $8,600 a week without...
That's pretty horrifying.
With no explanation. There was no attempt to explain why the father's budget was inadequate or unreasonable, or why the provisional child support is 4.3 times the amount of the father's budget.
That's madness.
It's very hard to see why any child needs more than perhaps $50,000 of tax-free child support per year, when particularly in this situation where there's no special medical, educational or psychological need. In fact, I think there's probably a good argument that putting that much money in the way of the children is actually going to be bad for the children. We've all heard of the spoiled children who get driven to school in a BMW and always seem to have lots of money at school to buy whatever they want. This is not really a productive way of producing children. I think it's with the only hope that if that decision is appealed, that there's some common sense brought into child support in that case.
Yes, and there is an extreme lack of common sense from the courts. Okay, well, should we go to another track?
We'll go to the music break.
Baby, Dad's on the Air.
Welcome back to Dad's on the Air. This the last time, but it's first day of March 2011. We're just about out of time. Wanted to mention to everybody that there's a show tonight, 7 p.m. Project on Channel 10, and it's on at 7 p.m. naturally, and that'll be showing nationally. And there is an item. It's either going to be tonight or possibly tomorrow night, but we expect it to be tonight on the fathers, the role of fathers, and the impact of the family court. There's going to be a couple of people interviewed that should be of interest to all our listeners. So refer you to that show, 7 p.m. Project tonight, Tuesday, 1 March. In the meantime, I want to thank our guests today, Dr. Jonathan Newby and Dr. Richard Fletcher, for being on the program. And for people who'd like to listen to the show again or like to go to those interviews, go to our website, www.dadsontheair.net. And so that's it for today from Bill Cable, Mediate Now, Ian Purdy, ianpurdy.com.
Yes, goodbye, everybody. Have a good week, and we'll be back next week.
We're dads on the air.